From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 2009 in the Finger Lakes in the southern tier of New York State. A young woman named Autumn Stoschek began warning her friends and neighbors about something called hydrofracking. Stoschek's family farm is near the border with Pennsylvania, and it had a conventional, not a fracking, but a conventional gas well on the property. She felt like she had gotten a sneak preview of what the gas industry was planning for much of New York State. Of course, they were in Pennsylvania. They were seeing a lot of that activity. But Stoschek found that, at first, no one seemed to believe this was a real or significant issue. Fracking? Never heard of it. So Autumn and her family began organizing. She wanted to beat the industry when it came to community involvement and knowledge. She felt like the agricultural industry was at stake. And 5 long years later, after hundreds of hours of demonstrations and work, Autumn saw Governor Andrew Cuomo decide to ban fracking in the state. But her story is more than activism. I invited Autumn Stoschek to the show today as part of our Summer of Food series of conversations. You could point to a number of places and times in her past for how she started on the path of making cider. In 2002, when Autumn received her cidery license, the New York State Liquor Authority informed her she was the youngest person in the state to obtain that license. She was 21. Today, Autumn makes cider at Eve's Cidery in Vanette, New York. That's almost due south of Ithaca, about 20 minutes. A friend of mine told me that their cider is the Ravenau of American cider, and that's an esoteric reference, but I can tell you that if you love wine, Ravenau is perhaps beloved as the best white winemaker in all of France. So how much do you know about cider, about the difference between apples for eating and apples for cider, about what to grow and where? We're going to get an education from my guest, and we'll also talk about activism as well with Autumn Stoschek, cider maker at Eve's Cidery. Great to see you here. Thank you for getting all the way to Rochester, by the way.
Thanks so much for having me, Evan. I'm so happy to be here.
You're going to clean up all the errors in my introduction in just a moment there.
But, that was perfect.
Okay. All right. Well, before we jump into the cider work, I do want to just talk a little bit about your activism and your family past. The family farm that you described as being close to the Pennsylvania border, where is that exactly?
It's in a little town called Vanetten. It's sort of really right on the edge of, geologically speaking, the Southern Finger Lakes and the Northern Appalachian Plateau.
And how far the drive to the Pennsylvania border then?
It's about 15 minutes.
Oh, that's it?
Yeah.
I didn't realize that it was quite as condensed now. Okay, geographically speaking. Do you remember when you first became aware of fracking at all?
Yeah, I do. I remember the summer because it's the summer that my husband and I made the decision to return to my family's farm and move the cidery operation there and to live there and buy it and pay mortgage. And it happened to be that summer this thing was happening, which I had no idea about, which was the Millennial Pipeline construction.
Okay, and this was roughly when?
This was in 2009.
Okay, 2009, yeah, right.
And why were they doing that? It was a massive construction project, and our house was covered in dust, and there was busloads of Oklahomans being shipped around our town to, you know, cut down trees and tear the place up. And we kind of started to have this inkling that there was something, you know, bigger happening than anybody really knew about. And that's when we started hearing rumors about this thing called hydrofracking that was happening in Pennsylvania. And there was just one night when I finally said to myself, okay, I've heard this word enough times, I have to go on the internet and look it up. And I was, I think, just more terrified than I've ever been in my life. And that was sort of how I found out about it.
And what did you do at that point?
I started talking to friends of mine who were, you know, kind of anarchist, earth first people.
You have a big smile on your face as you describe them that way.
But, you know, it's one of the things that's was such an amazing experience about the whole anti-fracking movement for me, just the sort of diversity of people involved and how all these different people came together and brought this sort of like dizzying array of talents, you know, and knowledge to bear on one single fight.
It's a couple of points on that before you continue. The fracking industry has portrayed the opposition as really monolithic, a small block of people, and what you're describing is much more diverse than that, which is interesting.
Well, and you know what? That's a really good point because I think that's one of the biggest failings of the modern environmental movement. And that's one of the things that we knew right away when we realized what was happening or about to happen to our town and to New York State. You know, when we got into this, the very first thing we started talking about is we need to engage with the people who live here and hear how they actually feel about their homes and their environment and use that language and keep the fight real and grounded and not let it, you know, veer off into this sort of like greenwashing and
sure.
Prius driving. Excuse my
hey, I drive
reference there. But it's a very poor rural area where
yeah.
we live.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, we got so close in our little town, considered to be a very conservative area, to getting the town to sign a fracking ban, because the majority of the residents in our town signed a petition to ban fracking.
And I wanted to ask about that diversity and about that grassroots movement, because you and I both know a guy by the name of Rick Rainey in the Finger Lakes. Rick is a well, now, whether he wants to be called it or not, he's a winemaker at a place called Forge Cellars, one of the finest wine companies in the Finger Lakes. And Rick, I think, I remember having a conversation, whether it was a year or two ago, I don't quite recall, where he was offended by this idea that the industry had put forward that the opposition came from Manhattan. The opposition came from liberal cause makers in big cities, not the actual population in the Southern Tier, in the Finger Lakes. And Rick said, that is so wrong. And if you lived here, you would see that. And to describe it as, you know, sort of people parachuting in from big cities with a cause they didn't understand, Rick said, is unfair. You feel the same way?
Oh, absolutely. And it's not just the gas companies, but the media as well. Because it's just a familiar story. But like I said, I think that was part of the success of the movement. And you know, my experience of it was so different than that. I know. And we met in our living room with, I think, you know, half a dozen just, you know, regular country people, neighbors who live around us in 2009, and some of our anarchist friends and some, you know.
Do you have any non-anarchists there?
Well, I keep bringing this up because these people were so instrumental in, you know, it was really cool because my mom also got really involved in the fracking fight, and also my husband's parents. So there's this big contingent of you know, people and, you know, ranging from 60 to 80 in the fracking fight who are being trained in direct action techniques and campaign organizing by experienced, you know, environmental activists. And so that's why I keep bringing them up, because I think that was a really also a key part of the fight.
Sure.
That we didn't just immediately go down the sort of, okay, let's make comments to the DEC. Let's, you know, go through the normal, conventional, very disempowering route to resist an industry that sort of people typically do.
Okay. But back to kind of 2009, the industry was saying, we can coexist here. We don't have to come in. It's not going to be as disruptive as you're concerned about. What did you see as the possible impact on the agricultural industry? Again, my guest, Autumn Stoshek, is in the cider business, which we're going to be talking about. But you have friends in the wine industry, agricultural industry. What did you see as the possible impact on the agricultural industry at large?
So the experience that I had was that in 1999, my parents signed a gas lease on their farm, as they had done every decade since they moved there in the 70s, with a small mom-and-pop gas company out of Pennsylvania. If you had said in 1999, like, oh, and you're going to have a gas well on your property, they, you know, everyone would have left, because it's just something that it wasn't a real thing. They mm-hmm. just kept the land leased up. And in 2005, that mom-and-pop gas company was bought by Talisman Energy, which at the time was called Fortuna Energy. Talisman Energy is a multinational energy company. They have operations. They were big in Sudan. They have operations all over the world. And watching what a multinational energy corporation occupying your farm really means, I think made such an impression on me how the people that live on the farm, how the people that live in the town are completely powerless, that the DEC, you know, was a facilitator for the process that was being permitted. And
but powerless how? Tell me what was happening. Tell me about that.
You know, just imagine everything a gas company would tell you about, you know, how safe the process is, or how they take safety seriously, or that they employ, you know, skilled local people, or that they will clean up their mess after they're done, or that they will, you know, respect your property and not unnecessarily, you know, cart away, you know, 10-wheeler loads of your topsoil. just everything that you could possibly imagine, it's not true. And the thing about gas drilling industry is that once they come in, there's no going back. Once they have the approval, once they have the permits, at that point, there's nothing. You can't fight them. And we realized that they're lying about everything that they were saying, because we had the experience that that's what they do.
They took, I mean, did they express any sort of concern about impact on your property, safety?
So like specifically, you know, aside from that, you know, the farm was unlivable during the time that they were working there. They signed, for example, with my parents, a restoration agreement for after the well was drilled. You know, their mantra was, we come in, we do this thing, we clean it up, it'll be like we were never there. You'll never notice it. It's just a little dot in the field,
sure.
Right?
Yeah, we've heard that a lot, yeah.
So my parents had, like, an extensive legal agreement with them. And then, like, immediately when the work was being done and my dad was there every single day, they were breaking every single... I mean, I'm not trying to exaggerate, just every little thing. Oh, you know, you're going to do it this way. Well, they cut corners. Oh, you're going to, you know, bring in landscape fabric. Well, no, they cut corners. They just put the stuff down. When they were taking it out, they were going to, you know, do all of these restoration procedures, and they took shortcuts every single step of the way. And they wouldn't, my dad would be there trying to stop the dump trucks, but he couldn't stop the dump trucks. And then when my family went to, you know, the headquarters or the office, you know, the manager of the Southern Tier operations, you know, they blew him off and blew him off. And finally they said, if you don't like what we're doing, you can sue us. But what is a small landowner going to, like, sue a multinational energy corporation? They're used to just doing what they want and having their way.
And that was a conventional gas well, right?
That was a conventional gas well.
All right.
Yep.
So that was your experience in your family with a conventional gas well. You obviously had those concerns about hydrofracking and what would happen here. What do you think the impact would have been on the industry? I mean, you think the industry, some had said we can coexist. Some have said this will be the end of the Finger Lakes wine industry. Some have said something in the middle. You know, you're a cider maker. What do you think could have happened?
I think that, boy, that's a tough question, because the way I really want to answer you is to say what we have and why that's so important. So I don't really know what would have happened, but of course I have my worst fears, and I've seen a lot of what's happened in Pennsylvania, and there's always the worst case scenarios that you allow, you know, you open up the region to have that happen to your region. The thing that we have in the Finger Lakes is this incredible thing that is so special in this country, which is a vibrant community that's a land-based community. It's based on the tremendous natural resources that we have here to grow food, and like an awesome network of people who are so committed to doing that, and the people that live here who are so interested in consuming that food and taking part of that. And that's about resilience, and that's about hope for the future. And I think that that's something that we need to fight to preserve.
You think farms could have been gone?
Oh, absolutely. And water. I mean, in a year like this, Not only did the does the industry pollute water, but the industry uses massive quantities of water. We have wells drying up all over the county where we live.
We're talking to Autumn Stoshek, who's a cider maker at Eve's Cidery that's south of Ithaca. It's part of our Summer of Food series of conversations. I can't even count how many people told me, you're going to have to meet Autumn. You got to have her on the show. So when she walked into the studio 20 minutes ago, it's the first time I met her. And so it's great to have her here all the way up from the farm there in Van Etten at Eve's Cidery. And we're going to talk about cider in just a moment here, because that is, after all, what really fires, well, so does activism too. But just a couple more points there. You were concerned early on in this fight, starting in 2009, 2010, that if you didn't get organized effectively, the industry was going to do it and organize their own support for it, yes?
They already were.
Yeah?
They already were. And it's not just, you know, that they came into towns and, you know, bought the local fire department a new four-wheeler, you know, or sponsored a softball team. But they also were a big part in, pitting neighbors against neighbors. So landmen would come around and, your neighbors trying to, you know, stop you from making money for your family, you know, your hardworking family. Here's your opportunity. But, you know, you've got to get them out of the way. And so we had people have been neighbors for generations beginning to, like, not talk to each other. I definitely saw that it was a dirty, dirty industry in all sorts of ways. They didn't know what they were walking into. They're used to working in places maybe where people aren't quite so, so ready to defend their home. And as long as they weren't here yet, we had the opportunity to stop them and to define what the argument was. Once they came in and once what they were doing was legalized by the DEC, then you're just picking little fights.
But to be fair, you mentioned, you know, buying equipment for the fire department or sponsoring Little League teams. They would just say they're being good neighbors and community citizens.
I think that each gas company actually has a department in the gas company called the Good Neighbor Office.
Yeah, and they would say, what's wrong with that, Autumn?
There's nothing wrong with it.
Okay. but you're saying it can be effective at winning goodwill.
It's absolutely effective, and it's a very well-thought-out campaign.
The other point, I think, that I wanted to at least ask you is, surely you met some who said, we don't have jobs here. Give us a chance for jobs. I know we heard ourselves from some landowners associations, some in the southern tier. Closer you get to the Pennsylvania border, you saw a little more stronger support. Did you hear from that? What did you hear? What do you recall about those conversations?
So that's the energy industry's number one selling point. And it's jobs.
Sure.
And it's always industry's number one selling point. Especially in the southern tier and probably in Rochester as well, communities have been devastated when industries come and then they go. And so one of the things that we talked about a lot is that it's really important to not rely entirely on one industry, that you need to have a resilient economy. But the thing about the gas drilling industry that's really different is that they don't provide nice jobs. They're really rough jobs. Those guys come in and they drill like 24 hours a day, and it's a stereotype, but there's a lot of drugs going on and there's a lot of importing of roughnecks from, they just follow the drilling rigs. They're not employing local people. I had several years ago I was called to jury duty in Elmira for a sexual assault case. It was an out-of-state Oklahoman gas drilling worker. It's a stereotype, but it's true. And a lot of communities in Pennsylvania saw that the gas companies were just importing roughnecks. They weren't providing jobs. There's ancillary jobs. You know, they buy equipment from equipment dealers. They purchase gasoline at the gas stations. It certainly provides economic activity, but it's short-term.
So what did you think in 2014 when the governor made his announcement?
My kids and I went down to the creek and just stood in the water and enjoyed the feeling of knowing that this pristine creek was going to stay pristine at least for another couple of years.
Did you expect that decision?
We were hoping for it. We were fighting as hard as we could.
Hope and expectation are different things.
That's right. It was amazing. It was truly amazing. And I have to say, it's so amazing to me to have been part of that fight and to see it start from absolutely the ground up, from just nothing, and to build and build. And like I said, a diversity of people with diverse talents and knowledge just come and speak out and put themselves on the line, and so much hard work. And then to have a result was extremely empowering. And I think this is true for me, and it's true for a lot of people I know that were involved in it, that it's given us sort of the feeling that it's important work to keep doing and that you can win if you do it. You can't just sit there and say, I can't even get involved because it's too hard and we never win, because we know that we can win.
I assume that means then you don't think this is over.
We've got to stop climate change, or we have to stop rapidly increasing it. And it's the fight of our lives if we want a future for our children. This is one piece of that fight, but that fight is, it's critical.
Sure. But do you think the notion of fracking and the idea of well drilling in the Finger Lakes and the Southern Tier could come back and is likely to come back as an issue?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's we're not, there's always, laws can change.
Political leadership can
absolutely
change. So this is not something that you think you'll never have to dust it off and fight again.
That's right.
What about LPG storage and those kinds of issues?
It's all part of the same issue. It's all part of the same fight. We need to stop letting fossil fuel extraction and infrastructure devastate communities and have people sacrifice their health and their homes for these projects as a way to sort of subsidize fossil fuels. We need to account for the environmental harm that these things do, and we need to keep pushing renewables forward. And so by doing things like stopping fracking, we can buy time to move our energy sources over to renewables.
One more question on this subject before we turn to cider, which I'm excited to do. Another stereotype that you hear from those who supported fracking was, you don't care about the economy, you don't care about jobs, there's a lot of suffering, the closer you get to the Southern Tier, there's a lot of joblessness, what else can we do? Now, I'm not asking you to have all the answers, but I also know you do care about people. What do you think the economic answers are outside of gas and drilling?
Well, I'm not an economist, and really I am kind of just a farmer. So of course, this is the way I'm going to answer you. But I really believe in small scale agriculture. Our community a long time ago was full of vibrant small scale agriculture, and I believe that we can work to bring that back and to recreate it. I'm really excited. Our local school district has recently hired an ag teacher, and especially, our school district looks towards the Finger Lakes region, the wine trails, all of these things that offer a bright future for our children. So that's something that I'm committed to, helping to continue to build.
My guest is Autumn Stoshek, who is from Eve's Cidery in Van Etten, New York. We're going to talk cider in just a second. So let's get our only break of the hour. And Autumn is going to tell us about her passion for making cider and for how the process works. And, it's something for me. I covered the wine industry for so many years. I'm so ignorant on this, and I'm excited to talk about it. I hope you are too. So it's one of our Summer of Food series of conversations and our short break, and we'll talk about that next. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, in our first hour, in that batch of leaked emails from the Democratic National Committee, came a conversation about Bernie Sanders' faith and the idea that maybe he's an atheist and maybe that could hurt him on the campaign trail. Atheists feel like they are still largely shut out of national politics. We'll talk about it. Then second hour, previewing the Fringe Festival 2016. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Autumn Stoshek is here. And you're a cider maker, but people might not know much about it. The difference between apple juice and apple cider is?
Cider is the fermented juice of apples in actually every other place in the world where temperate climate, where apples are grown and people ferment it into something, they call that cider. In this country, we actually started calling apple juice cider during Prohibition because Martinelli's used to be a hard cider maker, used to be called a cider maker, wanted to find a way to stay in business when they could no longer sell their products. And they bottled juice in fancy wine bottles and continued to call it cider. And somehow that kind of stuck. So we have a couple of generations of confused people.
Well, we're working on that, see? It's partially why That's you're right. here. Listeners, again, if you missed it earlier, I said I had dinner with some friends in the Finger Lakes recently, and they had some of Autumn's products there. And they're really remarkable. It was eye-opening for me. And so I want to talk about the process, but I also want to talk about why you wanted to do this. You can take me back wherever you want, whether it was college when you worked at a farm and that opened your eyes, or what was it that pushed you in this direction?
So, you know, my story isn't like, oh, I've been dreaming about doing this my whole life. And then life's kind of an organic process. And for me, the way that happened was that I was working at a local orchard. And
so, local to you in the Finger Lakes, which is where down there again?
South of Ithaca.
Okay, yep.
And a U-pick orchard. And in the bathroom, we had all the trade magazines. And that year, 1999, on the cover of Fruit Growers News, they had the Fruit Grower of the Year. It was Steve Wood from Farnham Hill Cider in Lebanon, New Hampshire. He's kind of known as the godfather of the American fine cider. We're not talking about six-pack ciders here. We're talking about, you know, orchard-based cider. And so I read this article about how he had gone to England on a vacation, and as an apple grower, he was really intrigued by the way that they were growing their apples there and actually took a closer look and realized all these apples were being grown for cider, where millions of gallons of this stuff is consumed. You can find it, you know, it's in every pub, it's in every bar. And he collected cyanwood from apple growers there and brought it back to New Hampshire and started grafting it. So these are apples that are bred and selected over centuries for their fermentation qualities, not for their eating qualities. You don't eat them. And when I read that, I was also a waitress at the time and, you know, just love food and wine and the pleasures of the table. I when I read about that, I just thought, this is insane. I have to go meet this guy. And I got in my Dodge Horizon and I just cold called. I just drove up to New Hampshire.
You drove to New Hampshire?
So excited.
You didn't even tell him you were coming?
No.
Did you consider what happens if they slam the door in
your
face?
I know. And Steve was so gracious. I mean, here's this 19-year-old kid just showing up like, I want to do this. And, you know, he didn't laugh at me and he didn't send me away. And he actually tasted me through his ciders and told me, this is what you need to learn, you know, and he gave me a bunch of cyanwood. And that's sort of the beginning of my story.
Did you know at that point that eventually this would be a career then?
No, but, you know, I thought, okay, you know, maybe I could do this and actually find a way to prune apple trees for a living, because really that's what I had fallen in love with. And I don't spend enough time doing that. And
every wine grower I know says, I love the pruning. Like, you're the first person I've met who's like, you know what the best part is the pruning. But you love it.
I love it. That's the kind of thing. I just like being out with the trees.
That's great. And so the license came for you in 2002?
2002.
Okay.
Yep.
What was that process like?
Well, you know, the State Liquor Authority has come a long way. And another thing that we have to thank Governor Cuomo for is making a lot of changes that just to make doing business in the craft beverage industry so much easier and so much nicer. I don't want to tell bad stories about the State Liquor Authority, but it was different then. It was hard.
Okay. Well, you can keep it vague, but let me also ask you, when you're starting a business like that, you have to know if there, well, you don't have to know, but you'd like to know if there's a market for it. And was there a market for it?
There was no market for it. I'm a terrible business person.
I'm in a creative business. I know there's no market.
It's true. And for the first 10 or 12 years, every sale that we made was people, oh, what is this?
Right.
It's cider. Oh, is it alcoholic? Yes. Taste it. Oh, wow, that's really good. I think I like it. About 3 years ago, 4 years ago, you know, things started to really change. It's just blown up. And we started to get people saying, oh, cider, great. My sister loves cider. Or, oh, cider, I tried it at a party last night. Now it's people know what it is and they, you know, they're looking for it.
How many people say to you, oh, I thought it was going to be sweeter?
Well, yes, that's a whole other story.
Not necessarily in a pejorative sense, more of a surprise. I mean, that's one of the things because you have this, you know, you have our notions of apple juice, you know.
Why do you think cider is going to be sweet? Because your reference point is juice.
Exactly, and I'm not used to it as a fermented beverage. I don't have much experience with it. You know, some Rieslings are sweet. I'm not talking about sicky sweet, but I'm talking about the way that a semi-dry Riesling or a semi-sweet Riesling may be. And you have some very dry ciders.
Well, you know, it's a big challenge and sugar sells. I think that my hope is to look to, you know, our mentors in the Finger Lakes wine industry and know that several decades ago, not a lot of dry wine was being made here either. So it's hopefully an evolution.
My guest is Autumn Stoshek. Let people know where they can find you online, by the way. The business is online where?
EvesCidery.com.
EvesCidery.com. That's south of Ithaca. Do you do tastings there and tours there?
We do not. We are a small working farm. And, you know, you can call me and come out if you're really interested in it. But there's no gift shop. There's no tasting group. I would send your listeners to the Finger Lakes Cider House, which is a brand new cider tasting room that's run by our friends Melissa Madden and Garrett Miller in Interlaken on Cayuga Lake, say that a little slower. And they taste ciders from 5 orchard-based cideries in the area, and ours are one of them.
And you also have a week of events coming up, or what's coming up here as well?
Yes, that's right. So the first 10 days of October, we work together with other cideries across the region to do sort of a co-promotion event. Basically, the idea is to just get cider in, you know, everybody's consciousness right in the fall when everyone's thinking about apples. And so it's last year was the first year, actually, that we expanded it outside of the Ithaca area. And we had some events up in Rochester, and we're really excited to...
You're coming back here?
Yeah, okay. To have some more events going on up here and some more local cideries participating from the Rochester area.
How many cideries are there in this region or state, do you know? Roughly?
Gosh, I wish I had prepped by having the answer to that question, but it's phenomenal how much it's grown in the past couple of years. I believe there's
dozens?
Something.
Is it 100?
No, I believe there's something like 55
okay.
in the state.
Okay.
Yeah. We're up from maybe, oh, three, like 10 years ago.
When you started, you were like, you could count on one hand?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. So you get this event first 10 days of October.
Yep.
You'll have events in Rochester, Ithaca, and where can people sort of find out about that and figure out what.
So the Cider Week Finger Lakes website is up and the dates are set. And if you go to that website, you'll start to see the different events in the different regions. And they're starting to be planned now, and they'll keep being added through the summer.
All right. Jackie sends an email and says, Evan, awesome conversation. How big is a bottle and how much does it cost?
Nice. So that's different for every cidery. The cider that we make is packaged in, you know, a champagne bottle. We make our cider with the champagne method. So we do a secondary fermentation in the bottle for natural bubbles, and we disgorge the yeast. And so it's a 750 champagne bottle.
750. So yep. It's like regular wine bottle.
Yep. And it retails for between $17 and $19.
Okay. So do how many different ciders do you make? About half a dozen or so?
Yep.
And they're all in that price range, or are some more expensive than others?
Well, we make a cider that we don't do the champagne method with. It's still, so that's cheaper because it's a lot of work to do the champagne method. And we also make an ice cider, which is for dessert. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, in a 375 mil.
Okay. EveCidery.com, if you want to check it out here, as one of maybe several dozen cideries now. See how much you're learning here. So are you ready for a wave of ignorant questions for me now?
Please.
On the process? I apologize in advance, but I'm let's get a little geeky with this. So you talk about the varieties. Apples that are for cider are not necessarily apples for eating. In the wine industry, a lot of people who kind of go out during harvest or help out, they're sometimes surprised that the berries, the grapes, look a little different, but they are delicious to eat. If you can eat a few Riesling grapes or Cabernet Franc grapes or whatever it is. What do apples taste like for cider?
So cider apple varieties are sort of typically classified into four categories.
Okay.
And cider, with apples and cider, it's a little different from grape wine making in the sense that the sort of elements that that make a really great beverage are not necessarily all contained in one variety, you know, in the way maybe they are in a Pinot Noir.
Mm-hmm.
So cider is by and large blends, although we do make a couple single variety ciders with exceptional varieties. And those blends are categorized by bittersweet, bitter sharp, sharp, and aromatic. The apples that are in the bittersweet and bitter sharp categories, they have tannin in the flesh, unlike grapes where the tannin comes from the skin. And so it's very surprising to bite into one because, you know, they have astringency, maybe a little bit of bitterness. So you maybe feel like you're sucking on cotton. The other thing about apples and eating apples is that their appeal as a fresh eating fruit lies largely in their texture. So people are really focused on how crisp and hard and juicy is that apple. And that's so irrelevant in cider making. Mm. And so when people were breeding and selecting for higher sugar content, polyphenolic content, they may not have been paying attention to the texture. So many times bittersweet and bitter sharp apples don't have a texture that's pleasing at all. But that doesn't matter because they're getting ground up and pressed.
Are they smaller?
Many of them are smaller.
Smaller.
Lower yielding. Okay. Biennial.
Okay. What do they look like?
They look like apples. Yeah, definitely. But, you know, it's funny because I have a really specific perspective on apple growing, in that I got into apple growing for fresh eating, of course, because there was no cideries or cider industry when I started. And, you know, in fresh fruit growing, everything you're doing is try to get this sort of cosmetic beauty, which to me personally isn't beautiful because I know the backstory behind it. But supermarket apples are blemish-free. They're large and they're red. And none of those things matter either to the apple tree itself who wants to spread its seeds or to the cider maker who wants high-quality juice. So our fruit in particular, because we grow our fruit for the juice quality, for the sugar content, for the acidity, you know, for the flavor compounds that make our cider what it is, they're going to look to you maybe ugly. We're not trying to, you know, do a lot of pest management to keep pests and diseases off of them. We certainly don't want them to necessarily be really big and full of water through irrigation. Mm-hmm. So they're going to look small and gnarly.
Okay. And are you picking at roughly the same time as growers of apples for eating are picking?
We harvest our apples depending on the variety.
You keep using wine terms, picking, harvesting. Sorry about that.
Well, one of the unique things about traditional European cider varieties is that they drop when they're ripe. So we're not picking them off the tree. We're picking them up off the ground.
Oh, okay.
And that's very important because a dessert fruit grower is probably going to be picking their apples at a ripeness stage that makes the apple retain its crispness. When we want to pick our fruit when it's absolutely dead ripe, it's no longer going to be crisp. It's going to be quite soft, but at its peak aromatic stage.
So more sugar accumulation.
Absolutely.
But still plenty of acidity?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
And so typically when, what time of year, what month is the busiest for you?
We grow about 50 different varieties, even though maybe 20 of them are our core varieties. Mm-hmm. And we'll be harvesting those apples starting at the very tail end of August all the way through the beginning of November based on the variety and when it ripens.
How much, what kind of production run are we talking about? I'm sure year to year it's different.
Yes, it is. It's very different because the trees, many of the trees that we grow, both because of the varieties that we grow and because we raise our fruit organically, are biennial. But our production is in the range of 2,000 to 6,000 gallons a year.
Which produces how many bottles? Or do you, you know, in wine they'll call it cases.
Sure, okay.
But how many bottles or how would you quantify?
Sure. Between 1,000 and 2,500 cases. It's very small.
Okay, so small production. Now, there are some Finger Lakes wineries. I mentioned Forge Cellars. I mean, they're not that different in terms of size of production, for example. I mean, many others sort of in that range. But not a whole lot.
Right.
Hail is an impact. What's the biggest threat to having fruit that is usable?
Well, this year it happens to be the drought, which about two-thirds of our orchard is on 35-year-old, large-size standard trees that are unirrigated. They're pretty drought-tolerant, but this year they're starting to suffer, for sure. The other really difficult event we had this year was that our trees broke dormancy and were pushing flowering 3.5 weeks early. We had an extremely mild winter, end of March, 70 degrees. Then in, I can't remember the date exactly, early April, we had a polar vortex. It came down. Ithaca had the lowest temperature on record since, actually, they've been recording temperatures. I believe it was 3 degrees in Ithaca. It was 6 at our farm. And our flowers were, you know, there was pink showing. So we had about 70% of our fruit, of our crop, was lost just in one night.
can you smudge pot it, or is there just no chance that cold?
I mean, according to the charts, you're getting mortality around, 90% mortality around 17 degrees at that stage. Wow. And we went down to 6. So, yeah, maybe if it was like 17, but it was
just too cold.
Yeah.
Okay, and a listener named Joel wants to ask about organic growing. And I know that you have a passion on that side, so go ahead.
Is there a specific question?
I think he just asked, has anybody asked about organic apples? So, you know, he might have missed some of the earlier conversation. Go ahead.
Awesome. So, I haven't always been involved in organic agriculture. And let me just qualify this really quickly. We're not certified organic at this point for paperwork reasons. But we follow and go way beyond organic standards. But I got into orcharding, through traditional IPM, and I've actually sprayed a lot of chemicals in my life. But when I had my daughter, my first child, I had this experience where we were doing a project in the orchard, during spray season. This was 10 years ago. And I often took her with me, to work. And I couldn't take her with me. I had to find someone to watch her because it was spray season and the orchard had been sprayed. And then I had this realization, actually, after I worked in the orchard all day long, with the trees all day long, that I was going to go home and breastfeed her and probably had, exposed myself to chemicals while I worked all day long and would be exposing her as well. And that's when I realized that I was either going to find a way to do it without using those chemicals or I was going to not be an orchardist anymore. And there's a, sort of a common story that you can't grow apples organically in the Northeast, there's a lot of fungal pressure.
Because we should say the sprays that you're talking about, at least on the grape growing side, that's to stop rot, mildew, downy and powdery mildew. Same kind of thing in apples?
Similar diseases. We have a disease called apple scab, Anturia nigualis, and that's a disease that will defoliate the trees. So, okay. You know, it's not just like does the apple look nice? It's you have to figure out some way to manage it and control it. We have fire blight. It's a bacterial disease. It's been pretty devastating to growers this year. Typically, antibiotics are sprayed to control it. It also kills trees. And so, yeah, so it's pretty challenging and also not a lot of, not a lot of guidance from Cornell. So
let's follow this up with this. I don't want to malign growers who spray.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's very tough, spraying or not.
Absolutely.
And if you spray, it doesn't make you evil. It doesn't make you not care about the world. But there is this notion that you hear, at least in winemaking, that you just can't go fully organic in the Northeast because of disease pressure, because of all of those factors. And you're saying same kind of thing in a lot of agriculture. What have you found?
So this goes back to people again. And, you know, like I said, I actually came to this as an IPM grower. And I also felt antagonized by organic growers and, you know, their sort of self-righteousness or whatever. So I definitely don't want to come across that way. But, you know, I also think that it's important not to be look at your limiting beliefs, I guess, is, you know, sort of my mantra. And I was very lucky to be brought into the fold and included in a group of young growers in the Finger Lakes region who were working on, you know, bit by bit, lots of different projects from lots of different angles, becoming or already were organic apple growers. Just a few names that come to my mind. One example would be Eric Schatt. He's the manager of Cornell Orchards, and he's a phenomenal apple grower. And Cornell Orchards, as you know, is not organic, but his home orchard is organic, biodynamic orchard. And so Eric has been tremendously supportive and offered so much insight and collaboration. Also, Garrett and Melissa at the Finger Lakes Cider House, and Mike Biltonen, formerly of Red Jacket Orchards, now of Know Your Roots Consulting. So it's not a black and white picture. It's just a warm, embracing community of people who are trying to solve these problems.
Do you ever spray now?
Yes,
okay.
We do.
Okay, because yep. You're not fully organic.
No, being organic doesn't mean that you don't spray.
That's another important
It means
point,
that
yeah.
you use only, like the literal definition of this is that you only use Organic Materials Research Institute approved products. So something that would be approved, they can't be synthetic products. So they're natural, you know, naturally occurring things like minerals, sulfur, for example, would be a common fungicide that is an organic approved fungicide.
All right. So without being the 30-second answer, without being overly self-righteous or judging, but when people say you can't do it organically in the Northeast, you say?
I say that you can, and especially for cider where cosmetics don't matter because a lot of spraying is about cosmetics.
Okay. So we've got about 2 minutes left with Autumn Stoshek, who's my guest from Eve's Cidery. And that's in Van Etten, New York. It's south of Ithaca. They are a cidery. When she started in 2002, there was a handful of cideries in the state. Now there are as many as 50 or more. And you believe cider's got a place next to beer, wine at the table. When I went to dinner with friends recently, and they had a bottle of Eve's Cidery, and I had never had cider like this, I felt like I was in on a secret. I felt like I was part of something that I just didn't know. Ultimately, your hope is that it's not a secret for much longer. But why don't you tell our listeners, you know, how you view its place at the table in the agricultural setting?
So, again, let me separate out six-pack soda ciders. We didn't get a chance to talk about that. We had another show. but dry cider. So there's a couple of things that it brings.
Can you do it in 90 seconds?
Oh, my gosh. Okay.
I know. Do your best.
I'll try really hard. So cider, we sort of want to promote cider as the new American champagne. It's local, and it's a fraction of the cost, and yet it can do many of the things that champagne can do. It's got the ability to have a lot of minerality when you're using the right apples grown in the right place, and it's got plenty of acidity that pairs well with all sorts of foods, but it also has tannic structure, so this isn't like a simple thing that tastes kind of austere when dry. Cider also has just a little bit lower alcohol than wine, a little bit more than beer, and so it's really nice, you know, welcome drink. An aperitif.
7-8%? Where is the
range? It ranges between 7-9%.
Okay.
So I like to drink cider when I'm cooking dinner because I can still have a glass of wine with my meal and, you know, not be feeling tipsy. And then I would also just say with dry ciders, they bring a whole different set of sort of flavor and aroma profiles that you don't have in grape wine because they're made from apples. And it's an exciting realm of possibility when you're looking at food pairing.
Can it age?
Ah, that's a good question. Well, I think our industry needs to grow up a little bit before we know that.
Oh, that's a very interesting answer.
But it
has. You suspect it can.
Well, yeah, I do suspect that it can because it's got acidity and it's got tannin.
Those are the keys for the structural forms of aging, right?
But I think what it doesn't have, and this goes for me as well, is, you know, a huge body of knowledge in the cider maker to make the cider to age. Do you see what I'm saying?
Sure, sure. Well, see, we're in on something that's still relatively new, but hopefully not a secret for much longer. And Autumn would be the first to tell you that Eve Cider is not the only one. There's plenty of other cideries. Check it out the first week of October when they've got all those events. EvesCidery.com. You made the trip all the way up from Vanette, New York.
Thanks so much for having me.
Congratulations on your success. Thanks for talking about your activism, your cider work, and for educating us on what it is you're doing. Thanks for being here.
It was really fun.
Autumn Stoshek. The Summer of Food. Go to our website, wxxinews.org/connections. Search Summer of Food. You can find more conversations on this kind of a scale. Have a great afternoon. Talk to you Friday.